Hello there, and welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of health discussion, debate, dialogue, health and science in the news. Yes, it's Ask Dr. Dawn once again, and I hope that you'll stay tuned and maybe even join in with a question or comment. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I thought that we had three emails all about this topic, so we'll start off with a 45-year-old healthcare worker with a 5-year-old child. So, is the H1N1 flu vaccination for me? What about my kids? What are the risks? And just what's going on with this? Second one, this from Christine in Albuquerque. I'm wondering if I'm the only person in the world who has never had the flu. I've had colds, sinusitis, ear infections. I'm a cancer survivor, but at age 57, I've never had the flu, at least not the high fever, chills, body aches, 2 weeks of illness bit. I'm a parish minister who usually volunteers in children's classrooms, so it's not like I'm avoiding trouble. So is it possible to be immune to the flu, and should I get a flu vaccine? Never have before. And this last one, from Teresa. Teresa writes, I work in New York State and have been informed that in order to be an employee at my hospital, I must get the swine vaccine when it is ready and the regular yearly flu shots. I've never had a flu shot, and I'm against them. I'm into holistic ways to keep yourself healthy. I do yoga, don't eat meat, take supplements, meditate. So what is in the swine vaccine, and will it be tested on enough humans to know the side effects in such a short period? I'm in my mid-40s and feel my rights are being violated. My sister lives in California and listens to your program, and she told me to ask you. Wow. So we have a lot of thought, a lot of stuff going on about the flu, a lot of questions, a lot of noise and heat, a lot more heat than light, I'm afraid. So let's start out with a little primer here on the H1N1. As regular listeners of this program know, there have been flu epidemics and will continue to be flu epidemics. This is a pandemic, meaning we expect more people to get sick. And as the H1N1 is a new surface marker virus, which most of us under the age of 50 do not have surface marker antibodies against, we're expecting to see younger people getting sick, and indeed that is the pattern. Now, the good news about the H1N1 is that people aren't getting deathly ill the way they did in 1917 during that flu epidemic. And that's very, very good news. And 6 months ago, we couldn't have said that, but now the pattern has fairly well established. People get sick, they get a flu, it's not much more serious, or it's in fact not more serious than the usual seasonal flu. It is, however, contagious for a bit longer, and so I'm expecting to see recommendations that children be kept home for a week or more. And when you try to decide whether or not to vaccinate your child, you need to keep in mind, what am I going to do if the child needs to be out of school for a week? Am I going to have to take off work? Is that going to be feasible? So that's one calculation. With respect to the issue of safety, let's take a few moments and talk about that. There's an autoimmune condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome, and it can occur after a viral infection. It can occur after a vaccination. It is a molecular mimicry phenomenon. If you listened to last week's program, you'll be up on what molecular mimicry means, but for those of you who didn't, it's basically the virus or the vaccine or the food or the whatever, fill in the blank, has a surface marker composed of protein and sugar that the immune system learns to recognize and attack by forming antibodies against it. And then those antibodies are wandering around in the bloodstream and they come across a human body tissue that has a similar protein and sugar molecule on it. And my goodness, the key fits in that lock too. So the antibody attacks that tissue. In the case of Guillain-Barré, that tissue is the spinal column, the motor neurons, and so you end up with a paralysis phenomenon. Very scary disease. Eventually, most people recover. The immune system reaction damps down and the person recovers fully or partially from their paralysis. But the paralysis, if it ascends all the way up to the diaphragm, which it can do, can be fatal. So this is a very scary disease. In 1976, we had avian swine flu, and we had, this was an H1N1, I believe, but it was a swine flu, and pigs are closer than chickens, and so maybe there was, maybe there wasn't, that's still controversial, something in the flu or something in the flu vaccine, but there was a bump in the very, very rare condition, Guillain-Barré syndrome. There was an increased rate that year. It was attributed to the flu vaccine, although that's never been proven and probably never will be decided definitively. Now we have a new situation, a new swine flu, a new H1N1, and the possibility is that whatever that surface molecule is, it could be in the vaccine or it could be in the flu. Maybe we are looking at increased numbers of people getting this molecular mimicry phenomenon. We don't know and we can't know. So who are they rolling out this new, not well-tested vaccine? Let's be honest about it. It can't be well-tested. It's new and we're rolling it out in a hurry because we're facing a pandemic. That all makes sense. Well, it's being given to the healthcare workers, the ambulance drivers. It'll go to the first responders, the people who are most likely to be exposed if this pandemic ramps up and we end up with lots of people in the emergency room. You'd like to see all of the people in the emergency room who are valuable, which is to say the nurses, the techs, the doctors. You'd want to keep them low risk for getting infected or getting badly sick. So they'll get the vaccine first. That's a good thing. That's a high risk group, and it's also a high benefit group. Because they have a greater risk, they will get a greater benefit. And so they should be prepared philosophically to accept a greater risk from taking a new untried vaccine. And these are, for the most part, healthy people with competent immune systems. So the vast majority of the people who will receive the vaccine in the first wave will be the ones who test it effectively for Guillain-Barré. If we're going to see a 100-fold increase in something nasty as a result of using this vaccine, this is the group that's going to tell us that. Then we roll it out to the second wave of people, which would be the high-risk groups, pregnant women, healthcare workers, people caring for infants under 6 months of age, children and young adults from 6 to 24 years. That was the group that died in Mexico. That's the group we're worried about. People from 25 to 64 with underlying medical conditions like asthma or diabetes. And altogether, that works out to about 159 million individuals. Oddly enough, the group that is normally at greatest risk from flu, which is the elders, are not at greatest risk from this flu because they're old enough that their immune systems have actually seen H1N1. And while they do get it, they don't get it badly, which is a complete paradox from what we're normally used to. So to the 45-year-old healthcare worker with the 5-year-old, get the vaccine or yourself, stall maybe for the kid, be prepared, have that backup child care plan. And if you have an infant under 6 months of age in the household, then really both parents should probably get the vaccine because they're going to vector at home. I would keep the 5-year-old out of school if the vaccine hits it because you've got an infant in the house and you need to protect the infant. To the healthcare worker who feels her rights are being violated, well, this gets into a fairly well-established principle of bioethics, Teresa, which is to say, first of all, you work at a hospital. The people who are in that hospital have a right to insist that you not be a danger to others. This is the patients and the administrators. They both have that right. And historically, when individual rights come up against public health issues, individual rights lose. And this would be in cases of quarantine. This is in cases of if you are a carrier of a disease, you aren't allowed to work in a restaurant. If you're a carrier of salmonella, you can't. We won't let you. If you have MRSA, and I remember this in the early days of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and you're a nurse, you can't work in the intensive care unit. We won't let you because you'd be putting other people at risk, and you don't have a right to put other people at risk. So to the person who's the healthy 57-year-old who is wondering if she could be immune to all flus. No, I don't think so. I think you've got a really good immune system and you've been lucky. Should you have the flu vaccine for influenza, regular influenza? I'd say that's up to you. You're not in a high-risk group. As far as the H1N1, you're definitely not in a high-risk group, and you should go to the end of the line, the people who have a greater risk of health damage or severe illness should be the ones we vaccinate first. And I think I've covered all of the emails and maybe most of the questions that you may have been asking yourself. Another email, this one from Suzanne in Dusseldorf, Germany, writes about low zinc levels. I was in Santa Cruz this summer, listened to your show several times and liked it. I have a question. I have a very low zinc level in my blood test, around 50, and it's supposed to be at least 70 to 150. This has been going on for quite a while. I'm taking zinc supplements, but my zinc level does not get any better. So my doctor thinks that I'm not absorbing the zinc, and I need to get zinc shots a couple times a week, which is quite time-consuming. I'm healthy, but tend to get infections frequently, and it turns into asthma most of the time. I notice that when my zinc level is very low, I lose more hair than normal. Do you have any suggestions on what to do? Well, Suzanne, I'm just going to say kudos to the Germans for actually checking zinc levels in someone who gets frequent infections. That's more, I think, than would happen in conventional medicine in this country, even though it's a very appropriate thing to do. So three cheers for Germany. I'm wondering if your problem with your zinc could be related to an excess of copper. I would look at your supplements, see whether or not you are getting copper maybe from your pipes, or maybe there's copper in your nutritional products, or maybe your cooking utensils. But anyway, I would seek to reduce copper intake because copper and zinc compete with each other for absorption in the intestine. And if you're needing shots, you're obviously not doing good intestinal absorption. Another issue might be that you're taking your zinc supplements with something else, perhaps a calcium supplement that is binding it, or your zinc supplement is not breaking down in your stomach, not dissociating because you don't have stomach acid. So taking your zinc supplement perhaps with a little bit of vinegar or some lemon juice might help with that. Those are some off the top of my head thoughts. If you're just zinc, I would wonder about other nutrients as well and wonder if maybe you have a small intestine issue that's interfering with the absorption of nutrients. So just a little riff on the subject of low zinc, and I hope you find it helpful. And we're going to Debbie in Ben Lomond. Hello, Debbie, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question is more of a dental-orientated thing. It's, my son has like three or four really bad infections in his mouth from bad teeth. I was wondering if you or your listeners might know anywhere he could go. He's an unemployed musician. He doesn't have any regular income. You know, he gets money here and there, but he's in a whole lot of pain and he's suffering, and I'm really worried about that infection going up into his brain. And he's in a lot of pain. He can't sleep. I don't know what to do for him.
Yes. Well, I think you've just made a really good argument for healthcare reform right there.
Oh, definitely.
But they haven't actually even talked about teeth. And once we get healthcare reform, that's going to be the next big, you know, that one's off the event horizon in Washington. But, you know, there's a lot of bad teeth out there, and bad teeth are bad for your health. So that will have to be addressed. At the moment, however, there is an organization called Dientes, D-I-E-N-T-E-S, which is low-cost dental care for the low-income community, for people without insurance. I believe that they are located in Mid-County, Mid-Santa Cruz County, and I know you can find them fairly easily by just looking in the phone book or Googling them.
Oh, okay. Is that over by Moe's Alley and Toys R Us area?
They were there. I don't know if they're still there, but if they're still at the old location, that would be true. My producer is reminding me there's a group in town called Western Service Workers. They're over on Mission Street. And I work with them. I do some free clinics with them, actually. And I believe that they do have for members, and the membership price is basically a dollar a year, plus you have to pitch in and do food distributions and man tables and do things like that.
Western Service Workers.
Right. And they are over on Mission Street, as I said, between Walnut and Laurel. So those are two resources to maybe get to some dental care. And my producer tells me that the online... it's Dientes Online. I'm going to spell this slowly. D-I-E-N-T-E-S T-E-S, and then the word online, no hyphen, all run together, .org.
Okay, great. Okay. In the meantime, I've been telling them to do like warm salt water rinses and with cloves and maybe a little golden seal. Do you think that's helpful for the infection?
Yes, I do. The golden seal is good for the infection. Peroxide, actually, hydrogen peroxide, and making a paste of hydrogen peroxide in baking soda.
Baking soda, okay.
And then rubbing that on the base of the tooth.
Okay.
That's a good way to get some antibacterial action going as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Good luck to you, and good luck to your son.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Gary in Santa Cruz, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks. I'm calling today. I've had like an ongoing bunch of symptoms that I believe they're stress-related, but I'm not sure. And I've been to a local naturopath a couple years ago, and we went through blood tests and all kinds of types of things. And things still kind of manifest themselves, and I'm not sure if it's triggered by stress, but I kind of think it is. But
can you narrow it down for me a little bit? Because I'm not really hearing your question.
Okay, the question is, I have some symptoms. I have sometimes ringing in the ears. I can get some canker sores. These things are, they were kind of spaced out, you know, as far as when they would come on, and now they seem to be getting, you know, closer together.
Okay. And how's your stress level, though? Are you doing anything to control it? What do you do to reduce your stress?
Well, I try to exercise and just try to get up and be busy and try to get my mind off of certain things and just keep moving forward.
Okay. Well, that's not a good strategy. Gary, look, we have a very stressful society, and we're under production quotas that are unheard of in the prior history. Even immediate post-industrial revolution, people had more downtime than we do. So we've got to think in terms of reducing the fight-or-flight response. So exercise, well, exercise increases the fight-or-flight response for most of us. It raises your adrenaline. And yeah, it makes you feel better. You feel more relaxed because you get the endorphin, but you get the endorphin because you've actually had the adrenaline and you've hurt yourself and the endorphin comes in. That's not the same as relaxation. And keeping busy and keeping yourself distracted and trying to keep your mind off things, not the same thing as relaxation at all. So it's very plausible that ringing in the ears and canker sores and a variety of other sort of come and go physical ailments can be related to spending too much time in adrenaline fight or flight mode and not enough time in parasympathetic tend and mend mode. Let me give you my favorite metaphor for this. Ever had a cat? If you have, or if you've lived near a cat or even across the street from a cat, you've seen the two modes that I'm talking about. You've got the cat with the hair standing up going, kss. That's adrenaline. That's fight or flight. The cat is trying to figure out, do I fight with my claws or do I run? And they're showing signs of adrenaline excess at that moment. And then you've got the parasympathetic cat. Same cat, different day, lying on the windowsill, in the sun, on its back, feet in the air, purring, just blissing out. Okay, that's the parasympathetic cat. That is the tend and mend cat. That is the cat who is in balancing all of that adrenaline with a lot of acetylcholine. We don't do enough of this lie in the sun and purr. And as a person, what you need to do is find your windowsill. Maybe it's Tai Chi, maybe it's meditation, maybe it's yoga. Although I would caution you, there's stressful yoga, so you want to be careful that the yoga class you take has lots of breathing involved. But something along the lines of a meditational practice that you actually do every single day, listening to a relaxation tape in the morning before you go to work or when you come home, or doing breath work. Breath work is the easiest one to learn. But that's how you relax, not distraction. Distraction is actually going to cause more adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So
yeah.
You got to balance your life out here. And you need to be taught how, because your culture didn't teach you. And you evidently don't know how. So you got to go learn. And then once you've learned a couple of different methods, one of them's going to stick. And you'll do it. And it will transform your life and make you healthier. And reduce your risk of heart attack and cancer and help you live longer and all the good stuff. Okay?
Okay, I appreciate that. That's a good tip.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Ruby in Aptos. Hello, Ruby. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I am a 32-year-old female who is currently pregnant. I'm in my, just started my ninth month. And I'm receiving a lot of pressure to get the swine flu vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
However, my history is that I've never had to be hospitalized. The last time I got the flu was probably 10 years ago. I've had to take antibiotics twice in my life, and I've just never been a vaccine person. So
Understandable. You're wondering, why do I need to get the vaccine?
Yeah, because I've heard that there's some vaccines have mercury in them, which I know is not good for the fetus, and I feel like I'm not confident that enough tests have been done on pregnant women to see if there are any side effects.
What's your occupation?
I'm an office manager.
All right, and so you are probably not in too much direct contact with the public. You're not touching hands with 50 to 70 people a day.
No, and I work in a very small office with 10 people.
Good, so you can, here's the scoop. If you get this particular flu, and this is new, it's mm-hmm. unique to this flu, if you get it and you're pregnant, you get very sick, much sicker than we expect you to. So there's something about being pregnant and getting this flu, probably related to the fact that your immune system changes when you're pregnant. This is hypothetical. I want to emphasize, nobody's done the research to prove this. It just makes sense, knowing the physiology. When you're pregnant, you've got a foreign body. It's called your baby.
Mm-hmm.
And your immune system would have attacked that foreign body like you would attack a splinter of wood, but it doesn't. And it doesn't because that mechanism is turned off while you're pregnant. Okay? But while you're pregnant, if you've got multiple sclerosis, you get better because that mechanism of immune system is turned off. So great. But if you get the flu, that mechanism of the immune system is turned off, so you get sicker. So that may be why we're seeing this. But it is the reason for the pregnant woman recommendation is that the pregnant women who have gotten the flu so far have gotten very sick.
Okay.
And when the mother gets very sick and runs a fever, one of the worst things you can do for a developing baby is overheat it. Mm-hmm. Much worse than a little bit dab of mercury, believe me.
Okay.
You give that woman a temperature of 102 for 3 days, and you've done more potential birth defects than any amount of vaccine mercury could possibly do.
Okay.
So it's a gamble. But if you do get sick and you do get a fever, because these women who are pregnant and get it do get sick, the fever's a good bet, the damage to the baby is higher. So the risk to the fetus of taking the vaccine is, it depends. If we could read the future and say, okay, you're the one who's going to get the flu, then maybe we would just vaccinate those people. But we have to kind of vaccinate all pregnant women as a priority, with the idea that this is our best shot. This is our best move. And it's a nebulous situation, and you cannot have a guarantee of safety with a new vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you've got a risk either way. And if you were a school teacher, I'd be like, you're getting the vaccine, honey. Since
right.
you're sort of in a situation where you can wash the heck out of your hands
mm-hmm.
and be very, very careful, you might make the argument, well, I'm too creeped out about the possibility of some unknown side effect. And if you do get sick and your baby is born with, has a cleft palate or, you know, webbed fingers or whatever, you'll never know for sure that it wasn't because you didn't take the flu shot, and you'll have to live with that.
Even though I'm in my ninth month, I only have 4 more weeks to go.
Your chances of having a birth defect are lower at that age because most of the things have formed.
Right.
So you're looking more at preterm labor as a result of the thing. And at 9 months, at 8 months, the baby's probably got viable lungs. So you might be one of those people who could say, you know, I'm going to take my chances, and that would be your best move. But it's such a crapshoot. I don't think anyone can give you solid numbers in terms of what's my move.
Right. And so I was thinking maybe I'll wait, and then once the baby's born, then go out and have one right away.
Where do you live?
In Aptos.
Okay, so you're in this area.
Mm-hmm.
You're not in the schools yet. Do you have any children in school?
No.
Good. Yeah, I think that's a reasonable thing for you to do, to wait. And
I feel like I'm fairly low exposure.
Yeah, and once your infant's born, you definitely need the shot, because we can't vaccinate infants under 6 months. And,
right.
And they get sick.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's a gnarly issue, and trying to figure out what's my move under my circumstances. I'm a great one in individualization. Either way, you're going to get the consequences of whatever decision you make. You're either going to get the flu or not get the flu. You're either going to get very sick or not. You're either going to expose somebody or not. And I believe that unless you have reason to expect that you are going to have a very bad reaction to the vaccine, not just creeped out by the concept, that the public health advice that we're getting is the right advice. Soon as I can get my hands on it, I'm getting that flu shot. And that is my recommendation. If you're older, you're actually safer, which is kind of fun for once. But I'm still in a high-risk group because of my exposures. Let's take a moment and go to that question from Barb in Seattle. I wanted to be sure I covered that briefly. And Barb wants to know, are the saliva and urine tests from Neuroscience for neurotransmitter levels accurate and reliable? And could aspartame from numerous pieces of Wrigley's extra sugarless gum a day cause a high glutamate level? Well, aspartame does break down to glutamate, and it's absolutely true that if you are chewing a lot of sugarless gum with NutraSweet in it or aspartame, that you could have, due to a variation in how your body detoxifies the aspartame, you could end up with high serum glutamate levels, which would show up in the urine and show up in the saliva. Neuroscience and these other kits where they're looking at urine and saliva and extrapolating, saying that this means something about neurotransmitters, and therefore if we give supplements, we're going to affect neurotransmitters, is a very controversial area in functional medicine. Some people really believe that amino acid levels in blood or urine are meaningful, and other people say they're not. And one of the problems is your brain makes these neurotransmitters, but so do your intestines. And more than half of your body's serotonin level comes from your intestines. So knowing that there's X amount of serotonin breakdown products in your urine doesn't really tell you whether the brain's serotonin is low. It's not a very precise test. And when you do the testing and say, okay, we've got low levels of this amino acid in the urine or low levels of this neurotransmitter, either one, and then you supplement with a targeted formula, the success rate is variable. Maybe less than 50% show improvements. So does that mean that it's placebo, or does that mean that it only works for some people? It means it only works for some people. Now, you listed a lot of treatments, all from neuroscience, that were being recommended by the doctor, and that one does make me nervous. And the reason is self-interest, right? If you're a lab and you also happen to sell the cure for the disease that you identify with your lab tests, you have a conflict of interest, and I'm not happy with that. So I generally do not order labs from entities that also sell product or own entities that sell product, because I feel that they can't be objective about their findings. They've got a financial interest in finding something wrong with you and selling you the cure. So that's my take on your question. As far as the products are concerned, I looked them up. Each of them is pretty good. Altogether, there's a little bit of redundancy, but I'm not comfortable with the course that's been suggested here. If you'd like to talk with me further, you can go ahead and message me back. Let's go now to Frank in Salinas. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling for a friend who's 72 years old, has been taking iron supplements for months, and it doesn't increase his iron saturation, which is 7, and ranges like 20 to 50.
Okay, and, so he has low iron. Is he also anemic?
Don't know.
Okay.
How would you...
Well, he would have a low hematocrit or a hemoglobin. Generally, we don't give iron to elders unless they're anemic, because iron is kind of inflammatory, and so it's not a good idea to give iron to people who don't need it. So I'm assuming that the reason they're giving him iron is because he's got iron-poor blood, and that's manifesting with an anemia. And so my first thought is, could he be losing blood because he has a colon cancer that hasn't been identified, or an ulcer that hasn't been identified, or something like that?
Yeah, they checked that, and they couldn't find anything. And he does. I do have a number here for hemoglobin, which is 9, and the range is 11 to...
All right. So your friend has anemia, and he has low iron levels, and we don't know where the iron is going or why it's not going in. So... there are tricks for absorbing iron. If you take iron with vitamin C together, that improves the absorption of the iron. but he may have problems with blood flow to the intestine or some kind of disease of the intestines that just interferes with his ability to absorb nutrients, like the lady that I was talking about earlier with the zinc levels. So if you can't get it in orally because it can't be broken down or it can't be transported across the membrane, then you're stuck with giving it by shots. And there are iron shots. So in a circumstance like this, I usually will have the person use a highly available chelated, that's C-H-E-L, chelated iron, and take it with a vitamin C or some vinegar. And if I'm still not seeing an increase in iron levels, and I'm sure that the person isn't losing blood faster than I'm able to put it in, then I give them iron shots and bring their iron levels up to an appropriate level, get the blood going again, and then I monitor them. Because if the blood level drops again and they become anemic again, then I haven't found the source of their loss, but there is one, and I need to look harder.
Is there anything bad about having it? Doctor doesn't want to give him shots for I don't know what reason. Is there anything bad about having anemia?
Yes, there is, especially when you're in your 70s. You don't have good pipes when you're in your 70s. Everybody in our culture, at least, has some atherosclerosis by then, or just about everybody. I shouldn't say everybody. That's never a true statement. Almost never. Sorry. Anyway, your friend is at risk. He's at risk for a heart attack. He's at risk for a stroke. He's at risk for all sorts of problems because he can't get enough oxygen to his tissues with an anemia like that. So it should be fixed. And the implications of being anemic, as far as his ability to think and his ability to exercise, are profound. And we do know that exercise is really important for staying alive after 60.
He says he does feel a little bit weak when he exercises.
I have no doubt he's not getting enough oxygen to his muscles.
Okay.
This really needs to be pursued.
Okay. Thank you so much for your help.
Thank you, and thank you for the call. I hope your friend is going to be fine.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Bill in Santa Cruz. Hello, Bill, and welcome to the program.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling for my daughter. She's had a series of intestinal irritations, moderate intestinal pain, cramping.
How old is she?
She is 15.
Okay.
No other symptoms, just discomfort. Generally, when it occurs, it takes about a week to clear. And we've had about five episodes in the past 6 months.
Is there any diarrhea or gassiness associated with this?
Virtually none.
What about rashes?
No.
Okay, she didn't have eczema when she was a baby?
No.
Okay. Is there any family history of migraine?
No.
Okay. So she gets this abdominal pain. It's persistent for a week. It doesn't interfere with her eating.
No.
No? And it doesn't affect her bowel movements?
No. I should say we took her in, she did a stool sample during an episode in May, and it came back positive for salmonella.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So was that treated?
No. There was no treatment discussed, which was surprising to me. But.
Okay, so that was in May, and she's had how many episodes since then?
Two, maybe three.
All right. Well, the first thing to do is see if she's cleared the salmonella. So get another stool culture. And if she's cleared it, it should be gone. And I don't think you really should worry about waiting until she's symptomatic. I think you should be able to pick it up on just a random stool specimen. If, in fact, she's become a salmonella carrier, which is rare but does occur, that could be causing an intermittent immune response in the gut that could be causing cramping and pain.
Mm-hmm.
How's her stress level? Is she in a very stressful... I mean, being 15 is stressful for some, but you know what I'm saying in terms of, is she able to have fun? Is she a very nervous person? You know, what's the read on her character and her life situation?
She's pretty steady. She does, but she's, you know, we've been asking that question, you know, looking for that stress-related.
Okay, so not really coming up positive on the stress thing. One thing I will share with you that is a possibility, that's why I asked about the family history of migraine. Maybe she had salmonella and she's become a carrier. We certainly need to rule that one out. But another possibility is what's called intestinal migraine. abdominal pains, typically only lasting for a day or two, or a day rather than for a week, though. So it's a little bit lower on the list. But it does come paradoxically and episodically. She could have some kind of a food reaction. It might be worth looking at. Is her diet good? Does she eat a bunch of one food just before she gets these episodes? I mean, do they happen after the day after she goes eat through a box of Captain Crunch while she's studying? You know, looking for things like that that could be ostensible triggers. It's a complex issue. And when we approach abdominal pain in the female adolescent, the first thing we look at is, you know, the ovaries and could this be menstrual related? Mm-hmm. And of course, you can figure that out by tracking the menses and looking at the cycle. Then you look at ulcers. You look at, like I said, food allergies, infections, which she has. And if you can't find anything, then you wonder about could this be the migraine equivalent episode? And in general, people do outgrow these or they turn into something more definable and more obvious. But sometimes it takes a while for it to manifest. Any clues on what relieves it? Does it get relieved, for example, with antacids, Maalox, Mylanta, things like that?
Haven't tried any.
Try that.
Did try Pepto-Bismol once, and it seemed to help a bit. But.
Yeah. I would start with plain old antacids, like the Mylanta, Maalox, and a good quarter cup of it. A big dose.
Okay.
Because if it's acid-related, and that's common, and if it's acid-related, that'll neutralize it, and you should get, you know, 50% improvement.
Yes.
Reliably when you do it. Uh-huh. And so that becomes a good test.
Okay.
Okay? He's writing it down. I love it.
Yeah.
Okay, Bill, thanks very
Thank
much
you.
For the call. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. I like it when my patients bring in notes, by the way. Doctors, we were kind of trained to be afraid of that or to go, oh my God, when we saw the patient pull out the notepad. But I sort of like it. But I would suggest to you as a patient that you also, if you're going to bring in paper, not only do you read from it, but you also turn it over and write down what the doctor says to you. Because it's been shown over and over again that people don't hear what we say as doctors to them, and they get less than 50% of it. So I'm always writing things down on scraps of paper, trying really hard not to use drug logo paper because I think that's tacky. Let's go to Henry in Live Oak.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I've got a problem. I'm a 58-year-old male. I don't have a sense of smell.
When did you lose it?
It's drifted away in the last 10, 15 years. I have a lot of allergies and sinus infections.
Mm-hmm. That is not uncommon. Well, did you ever use those zinc sprays, the Zicam?
No.
Okay, good. Because that actually was a bad idea. Those have pretty much gone away now, which is good. And you said it was a slow loss, so...
Yeah, finally I realized, no, I don't have a sense of smell at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really taste food very well either.
No, you probably wouldn't. So you probably had long-standing inflammation in your nasal passageways, which has kind of trashed out the olfactory receptors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to get back, but if you go after the inflammation, sometimes you can get recovery.
Mm.
It would be worth checking a red cell zinc level and supplementing. Kind of paradoxically, low zinc levels in the inside the cells will actually lead to sensory loss.
Okay, so
red blood cell zinc. Any lab will run that.
Okay.
Supplement if it's low.
Uh-huh.
What are you using in your nose right now?
I use Veramist and Claritin and nasal rinses.
How often do you do your nasal rinses?
Every day.
Once?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you sound like you're doing pretty well. I don't have a lot of good suggestions for you, I'm afraid. It looks like you pretty much got it covered.
Okay.
I actually haven't treated anyone for anosmia, but there's a guy who is very big in acupuncture circles who does a lot of ear acupuncture.
Uh-huh.
And he has reported some use of ear points for the nose in assisting people to return to their sense of smell. So
Okay. Those
are fairly straightforward things. You could go down to the local acupuncture college and try a couple of sessions, see if you notice a difference.
Okay, great. Thanks
right.
a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to give a nod to my acupuncture college, both scalp and ear acupuncture in general. When you've got odd neurological things, that is always worth a try. I'm surprised how often it actually does seem to work, even though this is purely anecdotal, and I can't acknowledge any kind of conventional medical or conventional physiological explanation for it. And if it's placebo, hey, if your sense of smell comes back because of a placebo effect, that would be wonderful. And who am I to complain that I don't know why it works? Let's go to JD in Santa Cruz. Hello, JD.
Hi there, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
So I have two issues I'd like to run by you.
All right, go ahead.
One is that I've spoken with you before, so it's got a complicated situation. Post multiple injuries, including electrocution and other head injuries and athletic crashes and all that kind of thing. I was taking Tegretol, carbamazepine, prescribed by my neurologist in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And back here in Santa Cruz post 9/11 and other accidents that had happened and trauma, that wasn't enough to block the trigeminal neuralgia, you know, flashing pain in my head.
Flashing pain in the face caused by an overactive trigeminal nerve, yes.
Yep.
And so the drugs that you were given, both of them, the gabapentin and the Tegretol, are seizure medications. But taken in lower doses than what we use to control seizures, they can have a calming effect on nerves. And so that was the intention of their use. But being that these are fairly heavy drugs and have a profound effect on the nerves, they can also create feedback loops and be difficult to discontinue. Is that what's going on with you?
Exactly. So I stopped taking, the Tegretol. Actually, first was taking the Tegretol and the Neurontin together, supposedly okay to do, and then felt strongly about the negative side effects and potential birth defects, was trying to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
So I got off the first one and am still taking the Neurontin.
Yeah, the gabapentin.
Yeah. But unfortunately, I've been having a lot, and I wasn't taking just a little. I mean, it started with twice a day, 300 milligrams, and then because of so much activity in my sleep, I ended up with three times a day plus a fourth one with sleep, twice at night.
It's still not, that's not a huge dose, actually.
Well, for someone like myself who's hypersensitive
right,
to medicines.
So you have,
hugely sensitive to medicines. So now
are
I decided
you going
to
be able to tolerate getting off of this? I mean,
well, this is what I'm dealing with now, and I'm actually experiencing less trouble with my balance, less unsteadiness, less blurred vision and nausea and all the really bad side effects, which, of course, one of my doctors doesn't think that me falling had to do with the medicine, but I am more steady in some ways, but I've been having just absolutely awful side effects of going off this medication.
Right. You're having withdrawal symptoms.
And then, of course, the combination of that and the increased head pain awareness and, you know, other pain in my body.
Well,
I'm just grappling with, you know,
how
to handle this.
I got the picture. So first of all, I think you should take a step back to whatever you feel is kind of got the face pain under control. So where your trigeminal neuralgia is tolerable. Start at that dose. Get back to that dose. And figure out what that is. Okay, once we have that number, we need to find additional treatment for the trigeminal neuralgia that works before you start backing off from that number. Because you have to control the basic reason that you got on the drug in the first place was unbearable facial
blinding
pain. Yeah.
Blinding pain.
So you don't want that back, even though the price of not having it is huge. You're still better off without that pain. So then you have to figure out, what am I going to use for the pain? And that may involve, I mentioned ear acupuncture a few minutes ago. We've talked about other alternative things, but maybe it means narcotic medication. Maybe that, you know, you can
God,
be...
I can't, even after surgery, I couldn't handle, you know, painkillers. Just really don't work for me.
Well, maybe you have to keep trying until you find one that you can detoxify. Maybe topical analgesics will work for you. But realistically, you know, you're just setting yourself up for failure if the pain comes back. And you've gone through this horrendous withdrawal process getting off the agent, and then you've got the face pain back and you have to go right back on it. That doesn't make any sense. So before you can hope to get off of the gabapentin, you have to have a decent substitute to cover your pain.
Mm-hmm.
and you haven't done that yet. So you need to do that. You need to do that. And then as a tapering schedule for a gabapentin, I usually use a schedule of about 50 milligrams per week.
Oh my God.
Which means you get a lot of hundreds. Mm-hmm. And if you're taking it four times a day, then you, instead of 300, you take 2.5 100s.
Wow. So I came off this way too fast.
That's my point. Way too fast. And it's going to take 6 months to get off of it without horrendous side effects. Your body has to get used to not having it, and that's the kind of time frame it takes.
Okay. But this is very clarifying.
Yeah, but you got on it. Remember, you got on it for a reason. You got on it because you needed it. So
it's just that the side effects, including because I'm a highly active person and it actually makes me more active and pretty agitated.
The side effects are huge, granting that you want to try to get off of it. But remember what that pain feels like. You don't have a good decision set here. You don't have an ability to just decide not to have the trigeminal neuralgia. Well, so, you know, you've got to weigh risk, benefit, weigh upside, downside. And I don't like all of the side effects you're having.
Nope. And including the kind of depression where you have, I was up at 400 and I had, not 400, four times a day, 300. And I had such intense pain anyway at times. But I also had depression with some suicidal.
I understand. And it's not an easy place to be. Listen, why don't you call us back off the air
and after
the show, okay? And we'll try to do some more.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Hello, Larry. And we've got just a few minutes. I wanted to give you a chance to ask your question, though.
Dr. Dolan, thank you so much. I'll be very quick. I have to be 61 years young. And Dr. Dolan, I'm thinking very seriously and looking into very seriously about getting a tattoo on my chest. I'd like to get a tattoo, just lettering above my heart. So my question to you is, what do you think of that idea? And then secondly, are there any bad effects or side effects of getting a tattoo?
Well, if you're 60, you've got a life...
61.
61. You've got a life expectancy of, let's say, 35 years, best case, 35 to 40 years, best case scenario. There's some people who are worried about the newer tattoo pigments, some of the newer chemicals. There's talk that they may have some carcinogenic effects. But I think that's not proven, and it's just speculation at this point. And you're probably not going to live long enough to get the cancer anyway. If you were 15, I'd probably advise against using the newer pigments, and I'd say the really thing I have against tattoos is when you try to get them removed. When you fry those pigments with a laser, you make some nasty stuff that then goes to the liver and has to be detoxified. And there's no evidence that stuff is safe, and there's really good theoretical reasons to believe that the laser breakdown products of tattoo pigments are very toxic. So if when you get it, be sure you mean it. And I would say go with the older pigments rather than some of the new blazingly bright colors, which are the ones that people are most concerned about.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, man.
Bye-bye. Let me just put in a little advertisement for good old-fashioned soap. Yes, I'm going to stand in my soapbox and I'm going to tell you about the virtues of soap. Recent research done at the UC Berkeley, the researchers put video cameras on 10 college students and watched them as they typed on their laptops. On the average, during a three-hour period, the students touched their eyes, nose, lips 47 times, about once every 4 minutes. Hand-to-face contact is, of course, a great way to get the flu. And many viruses can enter through the eyes. We scratch our face. We touch our nose. We touch our mouth. We don't even know we're doing it. Wash your hands. In a study of elementary schools, they put hand sterilizer in the classroom. They got a third fewer colds and 20% lower risk of missing school of any kind. Looking at households where somebody is sick, you reduce your chances of getting a gastrointestinal illness by 60%. If you wash your hands as you leave the bathroom and as you walk into the kitchen, squirt a little hand sterilizer on there. And just on the subject of H1N1, researchers in Australia put tons of H1N1 flu virus on people's hands and then had them wash their hands. And simple hand washing or sanitizer eliminated all that H1N1. So wash your hands, especially this year. I hope you've enjoyed this program. And I've certainly enjoyed bringing it to you. I hope to hear from you next week or on email during the interim. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.